Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, January 11th, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, of course, we're going to be talking about today's oral argument in the Friedrichs case, the teachers union case that comes up from California. Our guest is William Messenger. He's a staff attorney at National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, Incorporated, right here in Washington, D.C. For those of you who missed it, we did a preview telephone call, which should be available on our website. If you're still interested in this hour in a preview of the case, if you want to learn more about some of the facts in the case. But we'll get some of that today with Mr. Messenger. He's going to start with opening remarks. He's going to give us some background on the case and then talk about what happened at today's oral argument. But as always, we'll be looking to questions from the audience, so please do be ready with those. With that, Mr. Messenger, the floor is yours.
Thank you. And, obviously today's teleform is about the oral argument just conducted in Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. And the question in that case is whether it's constitutional under the First Amendment to compel public employees, here public school teachers, to pay compulsory union fees as a condition of their employment. And really what that case boils down to is whether or not the court is willing to overrule a prior precedent called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, which held that it was constitutional to compel public employees to pay compulsory union fees for collective bargaining activities, but not for political activities. And so to understand the arguments today in Friedrichs, you sort of have to go back and sort of walk through the progression of the case law building up to this point. And it's probably best to start the story with Abood itself. This was a case arising in 1977 in which a group of teachers in the Detroit area challenged under the First Amendment the ability of the school district to force them to pay compulsory fees as a condition of their employment. And what the Supreme Court said is, it is constitutional in the First Amendment to force these employees to pay for collective bargaining activities and other things related to collective bargaining. But on the other hand, it wasn't constitutional to force these employees to pay for political and ideological expenses unrelated to collective bargaining. And so what the Abood Court did was basically create this dichotomy between collective bargaining on one hand, which was constitutional to compel support for, and political and lobbying on the other hand, in which it was not constitutional. At the time, however, this generated a dissent from Justice Powell, joined by others, in which they said that, look, there is no such distinction between collective bargaining and political in the public sector, because in the public sector, collective bargaining is basically speaking to government with the idea of influencing government policy, here how the school district operated, and that there is no distinction in the public sector between lobbying the government and collective bargaining with government, and therefore the dichotomy that Abood created was unworkable. However, that wasn't the majority opinion, and so from 1977 to date, Abood has been controlling law. Now, after Abood was issued, there's been a number of cases regarding exactly how to enforce and implement Abood, like exactly which type of expenses were political, which were collective bargaining, and the court struggled with that. The court also struggled on the procedures necessary to determine of exactly how can a union exact compulsory fees, eventually the court requiring that the unions provide financial disclosure and all kinds of notice justifying exactly how they calculate the fee. But more or less, the courts were worried about exactly how to administer Abood as opposed to looking at its underlying merits. But that changed a couple years ago in a case called Knox versus SEIU. In Knox versus SEIU, the question presented was whether the union in that state could force California public employees to pay for a political fight-back fund in which the union was using to oppose ballot initiatives that the union opposed. So it forced people to pay for this without giving them a chance to opt out. And what the Supreme Court did in Knox for the first time was really criticize the underpinnings of Abood. In particular, the court said that some of the private sector cases that Abood relied upon didn't really say what Abood said that they said. That's Street and some other cases under the Railway Labor Act. And the court also made clear that compulsory fees was subject to exacting constitutional scrutiny, which requires that the fee be justified by a compelling government interest unrelated to the suppression of ideas that cannot be done through means least restrictive of associational freedoms. In other words, it's a very high standard. Abood, however, never applied that exact standard to compulsory fees for collective bargaining. But the court sort of imposed that standard because that's the standard used for almost all other instances of compelled expressive association. And finally, the court questioned the viability of what's called opt-out requirements. And this is when a union seizes compulsory fees, in almost every state, the union will take 100% fees from non-members unless they affirmatively opt out or object to the union taking their money, at which point the union will only take the fees for collective bargaining, not for politics. So, but Knox criticized that requirement. And ultimately, in fact, Knox held that the SEIU could not take money for this political fightback fund without first giving all these individuals an opportunity to object. So in other words, it required that the employees opt into paying for this expense as opposed to opting out. So that was Knox versus SEIU. Approximately 1 year later, another foundation case reached the Supreme Court, and this case was called Harris versus Quinn. Now the issue in Harris was whether it was constitutional to extend Abood beyond public sector employees to other individuals in their relations with government. What was happening in Harris is that the state of Illinois was forcing home Medicaid providers, who were not state employees, but simply received payments of Medicaid monies for their services to others, forced them into a union, and then started to exact compulsory union fees from them. So now you had Abood being extended to force individuals who were not employees to pay compulsory union fees. And the question is, could Abood be extended that far? In that case, foundation attorneys argued that, first, Abood should be overruled. That's bad law to start with. But second, even if it wasn't overruled, it should not be extended beyond the employment context. In Harris, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, went with the second option. And the court really did two things. First is, the court majority strongly criticized Abood and actually listed 6 grounds upon which the majority said that Abood appears suspect, the main one of which was that there is no difference between collective bargaining and lobbying in the public sector. Both are equally political. However, the court majority said it didn't need to overrule Abood that day because it could find that Abood did not extend beyond the employment context, and therefore the Medicaid providers in the case were distinguishable. And in that case, the court said it was unconstitutional to compel these non-employee providers to pay compulsory fees. The dissent, however, in Harris held that, you know, they thought that Abood was good law. They defended the merits of the decision and then basically said they would have applied it beyond the employment context in addition to that, or at least to the independent providers who were in that case, who the dissent characterized as joint employees because they received state money. So that was in 2014, the Harris decision. And that leads up to this case, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. Friedrichs is a direct challenge to Abood. It was filed by Rebecca Friedrichs, who's a California school teacher, and there's a number of other school teachers who joined with her, along with the Christian Educators Association. And they said flatly, Abood should be overruled. Forcing public employees to pay compulsory fees is unconstitutional. And that case reached the court this year. And to sort of understand sort of the arguments going on there, the Ms. Friedrichs, through her attorneys, are arguing basically what was said before, that there is no distinction between politics and collective bargaining in the public sector, that it's all equally political. And of course, the respondents, the unions in the state of California, are arguing, no, these are internal employment matters. They're not political, and therefore it is should be legal. Abood should be over, should be upheld. Now, in addition to that, there are some other arguments being raised that I'm going to mention here just because we'll probably talk about them later in talking about how the oral argument went today. And, of course, there's a lot more arguments at stake in the case. These are just the basics. The first is standard of review. As I mentioned before, prior to Knox, the court was never really clear on what standard of constitutional scrutiny applied to compulsory union fees. In this case, one of the key arguments of the petitioners is under exacting scrutiny, the agency fee can't be justified because it's not the least restrictive means to collective bargaining, because unions can survive on voluntary dues deductions, just as they do in federal government in 25 right-to-work states. One of the primary arguments from the respondent side, the state of California and the unions, is that this case called Pickering should apply in this situation, which requires a much lower standard of review, where the government really only has to show that there's the balancing test, that basically has to show that compulsory fees are reasonably related to the government system of collective bargaining. So there's a big fight there over standard review. And then the second big issue in Friedrichs is stare decisis, which is the concept that even if a decision may be wrong, the court shouldn't overrule it but for special circumstances. And so we could talk about the arguments probably later back and forth for and against stare decisis. But that's something very important in this case, because even if the justices think Abood's wrong, that in and of itself doesn't necessarily lead to the conclusion it should be overruled. So that was something to be watched for at the argument today. And so those are the primary things. And just finally to mention before turning today's argument, there was a second question presented in Friedrichs in addition to whether Abood should be overruled, and that's the opt-in, opt-out requirement that the court passed upon in Knox. In other words, what they're doing in California is the California Teachers Association will take 100% of dues from a non-member unless each and every year they send a letter to the union saying they don't want to pay for those political expenses. And if a teacher doesn't send that letter, the union takes all their money, including for its political expenses. So in other words, teachers have to opt out of the mandatory seizure, which, as you can imagine, leads to the union being able to rake in a lot more money just because a lot of people forget to do it through inadvertence, just through inertia. So the constitutionality of that opt-in, opt-out requirement was the second issue presented in Friedrichs. And so with that, the argument was conducted this morning, and discussing it both now and throughout our call, I'd like to stress that the transcript just came online. If anyone wants to read it, you can go to the Supreme Court's website at supremecourt.gov, click on Oral Argument Transcripts, and the Friedrichs transcript is right there. So you can read it at your pleasure and make your own judgments. And the audio for the argument will be posted at the end of the week on the same website, Supreme Court's website. They usually come up on Friday if you would like to listen to it. Now, I haven't read the transcript. I attended the argument today, so anything I say is based off of memory. So I can't say exactly what this justice said or that answer to that question was. But just generally speaking, the justices, the majority, the Harris majority, the five-member majority, most of their questions seem to express skepticism towards the union's position that, in fact, there was a distinction between collective bargaining and politics. There were a large number of questions on that point of that, hey, what is really the distinction here? Isn't this all a matter of public concern when you're talking about bargaining with the government? Most of the dissenters, Harris dissenters' questions seemed to focus, I mean, they had a variety of issues, but a lot of them went to stare decisis. The question of, you know, even if Abood was wrong, you know, should the court go that extra step and actually overruling Abood, citing reliance interests, you know, unions rely upon this income stream. Also, what special justification requires Abood, things to that effect. So with that, those were sort of some of the main ones. I mean, I can't cover all of them or we'd be here for the length of the argument. But those are sort of the initial impressions. And, you know, speaking for myself, I'm cautiously optimistic that the court will, in fact, overrule Abood based on today's arguments. But, you know, that's not worth much. I mean, you can't tell too much from an oral argument. So, you know, I wouldn't overread anything based upon any of the questions. But based upon today's argument, I think there's justification for some cautious optimism that the court will overrule Abood. And so with that, just that's sort of the basic summary, and I'll see what in particular everyone is interested in discussing.
Very good. Thank you so much. Let's go right to audience questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So once again, we've got quite a few people on the line today, but plenty of time for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller to begin the afternoon, but before we go to our first caller, let me make our typical commercial announcement. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Wednesday at 3, when we'll be talking about standing to sue, particularly as it relates to suits brought by states. That's Wednesday at 3. Then Thursday at 2, our Teleform is going to be about judicial selection, which should be an interesting issue, especially as the president's term comes to an end. And that's Thursday at 2. And then Friday at 1 p.m., all these times are Eastern times, we'll have the first Memorial Michael Lewis Teleforum. But do keep an eye on your emails and check the website for changes in the schedules. Today, the Friedrichs oral argument from earlier today. If you've got a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now go to our first caller.
Hello. This is Arthur Hellman at the University of Pittsburgh. There's been some speculation about Justice Scalia departing from the five justices who joined Harris and Knox because of an opinion he wrote or something he said 25 years ago. Was there any indication of that in the oral argument today?
Not that I heard. Most of Justice Scalia's questions seemed somewhat favorable to the petitioners, Mrs. Friedrichs. And so, you know, the basic answer is no. And I think, you know, I've read sort of the same things that was mentioned about, you know, Justice Scalia's Leonard decision, and, you know, some people are trying to read a lot into that. I never quite understood that. The issue in Leonard was not whether Abood was right or wrong. The question was how to make Abood work. In particular, the question was what test should the Supreme Court use to separate chargeable expenses, i.e. those related to collective bargaining, from non-chargeable expenses, those related to politics. And the court fractured in three directions, trying to think of some test to separate the wheat from the chaff that made sense. And Justice Scalia wrote a concurring opinion in which he came up with a particular test to make Abood workable in his eyes. It wasn't the majority test. And so basically what the justice was doing was trying to make Abood work, assuming, you know, the basis for Abood was valid. It wasn't a question of whether or not Abood was correctly decided, which is the issue today. So I sort of always believe that, you know, a lot of the banter about Justice Scalia and what he wrote in Leonard was somewhat overblown. Now, what does Justice Scalia actually believe on this issue? You know, I don't know. He signed on to the Harris opinion. He was in the Harris majority as well as in the Knox majority. So the fact that he signed those opinions and was a member, joined those opinions rather, you know, strongly suggests that he has serious qualms about the validity of Abood.
Well, I agree with that analysis, but I was thinking not only of the Leonard, whatever that is, separate opinion, but also of his general views on and the other government employee cases, the patronage cases and the government employee speech cases, where he's been quite willing to uphold restrictions on speech where other justices struck them down. Do you see any connection there?
Actually, you know, the second part I think was something that really came up a lot today with the restrictions on speech. And so let me sort of address both of them. The first is the patronage decisions. That didn't come up today. And for those on the call unfamiliar, patronage is when the government requires that its employees actually join or support a political party. And the Supreme Court held that was illegal, unconstitutional, in a case called Elrod versus Burns, actually 1 year before Abood. Justice Scalia, he wasn't obviously on the court then, in subsequent patronage cases, indicated he disagreed because patronage was common in the original understanding, not original understanding, in the first 100 years or so of the Republic. It was very common. You know, Abraham Lincoln would appoint people in his party, so on and so forth. And so based on his original understanding views, Justice Scalia said, hey, this was around at the First Amendment. It was common, or when the First Amendment was promulgated, therefore it shouldn't be unconstitutional. However, that doesn't really apply to unions because, you know, public sector unionism only really began. Wisconsin started in the late 50s, but it was really the 60s and the 70s that it took hold. So unlike, you know, only appointing political parties to government positions, patronage is compulsory unionism in the public sector is very much a new phenomenon. And this was addressed in the briefs, but did come up in the oral argument. But the second point, the employment restriction cases, did come up a lot today. And the sort of this is the Pickering issue that I believe I mentioned earlier in the introduction. So under Pickering, and a variety of later cases, Pickering sort of the beginning of the chain of these cases, the court held that when it comes to running an internal workplace, the government employers have a decent amount of leeway to restrict individual employee speech within the context of government operations, just as far as a managerial matter, because you couldn't really operate a workplace, or it'd be very difficult if employees were free to, you know, say whatever they wish when they wish. You know, you couldn't even have workplace discipline. And also the idea that you didn't want the courts micromanaging every single decision, you know, by a manager as to saying, hey, you know, speak politely to customers, that the government employee couldn't say, no, I have a First Amendment right to be offensive, you know, to the people we serve, things to that effect. And under the Pickering line, the court gets a lot, or the court gives a lot more discretion to individual restrictions on speech. And so one of the big arguments that the unions and state of California made was that the same analysis should apply to compelled support for a union. And this came up frequently at today's argument in the back and forth. And again, I encourage everyone to read the transcript or listen to it, and you can hear the exact back and forth over that point. With the, but some of the justices, if I remember correctly, did express skepticism on that point. I believe that Justice Kennedy sort of expressed skepticism that Pickering dealt with, you know, dealing with one individual employee who allegedly says something in violation of, you know, that the government doesn't want that particular employee to say, where here you have this categorical rule that you have an entire group of people, you know, who are forced to pay compulsory fees, whether they like it or not. And there's a whole variety of other arguments regarding the Pickering question. But a lot of the case, I don't want to say come down to it, but how they deal with Pickering will be important. And then just the last point on Pickering, not to belabor it, is this was a big issue in Harris versus Quinn. This was extensively briefed and argued there also by the unions, by the state of Illinois, and the Supreme Court rejected it in Harris and said that when it comes to compulsory fees, compulsory association, exacting scrutiny is the standard the court applies, which is what the court applies in every other instance of compelled expressive association. Elrod versus Burns was compelled, that was the patronage case, used that standard of scrutiny. And all the other cases did, including in the employment context. So there is that strand of case law there that justifies, you know, the heightened test here.
Well, thank you. It sounds as if there's nothing to indicate that Justice Scalia disagrees with any of the implications of Harris and Knox, which I think would lead to a vote to reverse here.
That's potentially correct. At least based on memory, I can't think of what he may have said at the argument that would have given me pause. But again, the argument was an hour and a half. I can only, you know, it sort of blends together a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the next question, let me ask you, you just alluded, Mr. Messenger, to the length of the argument mostly. Cases are argued in 60 minutes. This one had extra time from the outset. Does that give you, is that a reflection of the complexity of the case, or do you have a sense of that?
It could be somewhat the importance, but the parties move for it. On the respondent side, you had three groups that each wanted to present through their separate attorney. You had the union, the California Teachers Association. You had the state of California, which was defending its compulsory fee law. And also the United States Solicitor General wanted to participate in the argument. And with that many individuals, they filed a motion asking to extend the argument time to really make it possible for all three to participate, which is somewhat unusual. Usually they don't like to be split up that much, but with the extra time and because it was the only argument today, you know, I think that's primarily why they did it, was because of the extra number of attorneys. Although, of course, the real reason the court granted it, you know, who knows?
Very good. Let's turn back to our audience now.
This is Matt McReynolds of Pacific Justice Institute. Question for you regarding compelled speech. did the court today zero in pretty narrowly on the line of union cases, or did the justices have much to say about other areas of compelled speech, like the agribusiness advertising cases or the newspaper right of reply cases, fundraising cases, those kinds of things?
Not to my recollection. I believe there was one question, I'm trying to remember from who, which sort of was prefaced on the idea that, hey, there's a lot of compulsory associations out there. Why is this a big deal? Listing the compelled agricultural cases like Glickman, the Mandatory Bar Association, things to that effect. And in fact, there was at least some discussion about why bar associations were distinguishable. I believe it was with the Petitioner's Counsel and Justice Kagan, if memory serves me, about why the bar association, you know, is different. She was asking that of, wouldn't this, if Abood was overruled, would this take the bar association cases with it, and also with take Southworth down with it, which dealt with the student association fee cases. And the Petitioner's Counsel, you know, answered those questions basically of why the bar was different. Southworth wasn't getting into too much, but it was more about why the bar was different, and mainly because that fee there was used primarily for regulating the practice of law, and the things extraneous to that weren't actually chargeable. While here with a union, the primary purpose of this mandatory association is speech. It is to petition the government. It's not the operation of the legal system, which is also justified by a compelling interest not, you know, present here with unions, mainly regulating the practice of law. And this question, too, was actually addressed in Harris. And so to a large degree, a lot of the arguments today, now that I think about it, sort of recycled back what was briefed in Harris, what was argued in Harris. Obviously, it wasn't decided in Harris, because the court only went so far as distinguish Abood and say you couldn't extend it. But the Harris court, in the majority opinion, did distinguish the Bar Association more or less on the grounds that I just mentioned.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just two questions pending. You mentioned, before we go to the next audience question, you mentioned Justice Kagan, and we've, of course, talked about Harris v. Quinn, where there was a five-member majority. Do you have any hopes, or was there any indication there could be a sixth vote? I'm asking you to go beyond your cautious optimism and see if there was any form of interest in that from one of the other four justices that you perceived.
Not that I could perceive. And plus, you know, Harris was only 1 year ago.
Right.
And so, well, a little more than a year, year and a half. And in that, you know, the four dissenters, which is Justice Kagan, Justice Breyer, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg, you know, not only said they thought Abood was fine, but they were willing to extend it, you know, to these independent home care providers. So unless there was some sort of large change of heart between now and then, you know, in terms of reading their understanding of the law, or, you know, their viewpoints, you know, I don't see, I think it's very unlikely. And there was nothing today that really suggested that, you know, they had a complete change in the way they viewed the law. And so given the breakdown of the justices in Harris, you know, I think the real question is the Harris majority, you know, willing to overrule Abood? I mean, they strongly criticized it. There's no question it's not their favorite decision. But are they willing to take that next step and overrule Abood? And that's really the big question, because nothing at the argument today would make me believe that the Harris majority suddenly thinks that Abood is a, you know, a well-reasoned decision. But the real question is, are they willing to overrule it? And that, you know, remains to be seen.
Right. Very good. We've got three questions on the board now, so let's take another call from our audience.
Hi, it's David Tryon in Cleveland. So if Abood is in fact reversed, where does that leave us? Does that allow the unions to challenge, the public sector unions, to get any dues from non-union employees, or would it allow them to get what they determine through some sort of opt-in agreement that this is the amount that is required that we needed to negotiate, or is do we have any sense of what that would the final result would be on a practical matter?
Okay, well, assuming there's not a middle ground decision, you know, they don't sort of tinker with Abood and change the test, the line between chargeable and non-chargeable. If they overrule Abood, individual employees can no longer be forced to pay any fees to a union, sort of period, across the board. And so that we estimate there's about 5 million public employees who are represented by unions in this country who lack statutory right to work protections. So if Friedrichs does come out the correct way and Abood is overruled, all of those employees will gain the freedom to choose whether or not they want to support the union or not. And for those who don't want to support the union, they don't have to. And while certainly a huge improvement over the status quo, you know, which allows compulsory union fees up to about 5 million public employees, you know, in reality, that just makes the union just like every other advocacy group out there. You know, every advocacy group, you know, generally has to rely on voluntary contributions and support for its effort. And really all at stake here is for the courts to rule that unions are just like every other advocacy group, that people can individually choose whether they wish to support it. So the bottom line is if Abood is overruled, that will likely mean no compulsory fees whatsoever for public employees.
And how is that where there's been the right to work statutes passed? How has that affected union membership? What percentage of people have chosen to not join the unions?
There were some amicus briefs that discussed that issue. It varies, you know, as you can imagine, by state. But if my recollection is correct, I believe that roughly 90% of union-represented employees in non-right-to-work states are members, full members, so 10% are non-members and compulsory fee payers. In right-to-work states, it's 80-20. Usually about 80% of employees in right-to-work states choose to be union members, and 20% decline. So, you know, you can try to extrapolate those numbers out, but of course, every workplace is different. And so exactly how, you know, the numbers would break down, you know, remain to be seen of if Abood is overruled, what is the overall impact? But, you know, from our point of view, the National Right to Work Foundation's point of view, the most important thing is regardless of the numbers, it's the choice.
Yeah.
5 million people get to choose. Whichever way they choose is up to them, but the main thing is they get to choose.
Will they be able to ask for a refund?
That's a good question. That was a question that came up today. I forget which justice asked the petitioner's counsel, would this decision be retroactive or prospective only? I believe petitioner's counsel suggested that it'd probably be prospective. I don't know the law for sure on that matter. My understanding is that unless the court specifically says this ruling shall be prospective only, usually constitutional rulings are retroactive. So unless the court goes out of its way to say prospective only, they should be retroactive and should allow employees who were forced to pay compulsory fees in violation of their First Amendment rights to recover the fees that were wrongfully taken from them, at least back to the statute of limitations, which this being a 1983 type case, you're looking 2 to 3 years, depending on the state. The exact statute of limitations varies by state, to clarify that. So whether it's retroactive was a question asked, and we'll see what the court says.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Take another call now.
Hi, this is Aaron Solem in Alexandria, Virginia. I was wondering if you could address the second question, which was presented to the court, which is opt-in versus opt-out, and whether or not if the court rules that you would have to affirmatively opt in order to pay dues, what kind of follow-up litigation or future cases could be brought concerning that?
Yes, thank you. Yes, and with the opt-in, opt-out question, it sort of becomes, you know, where is, you know, the presumption? And I think that, you know, first, the opt-in, opt-out will need to be addressed whether Abood is overruled or not. So obviously, if Abood is not overruled, then the opt-in, opt-out question is still there. Do individuals have to affirmatively object not to pay compulsory fees for undisputably political activities? But even if Abood is overruled, The court still should pass on that question. That was a question asked to petitioner's counsel, and he said, yes, you have to address that question either way, because it all you're talking about how much money can you charge. In other words, even if Abood's overruled and the union's constitutionally entitled to take zero, if the court doesn't rule on the opt-in, opt-out question, or doesn't rule the right way or against those requirements, then the union could technically take money from everyone for political expenses, for collective bargaining, even after Abood is overruled, unless they object. So, for example, I believe an example given by the petitioner's counsel in the argument today was if you rule a different way, that means the governor of California could basically take 1% of every state employee's money and put it right into his reelection campaign, unless and until that particular employee objected to that money being taken. And his point was, of course, you wouldn't allow that to happen. You know, your government can't take its money until you tell it to stop, or for political expenses at least. And he made the case that the same should apply to compulsory fees for a union. If a union has no right to collect a fee, say if Abood is overruled, it won't have a right to collect any fee, then the union shouldn't be allowed to take money it should never have in the first place, unless and until an employee objects, because the end result would just be the union gaining money that the individual most likely doesn't want that particular union to have. And so did that answer the question, or did I?
Yeah, it does answer the question. I was wondering if there was any cases currently pending besides Friedrichs that deal with opt-in and opt-out, or if there's any other applications beyond just this case.
Oh, yes. There's actually a case. The National Right to Work Foundation is representing child care providers in a case that's currently being held before the Supreme Court called Schloud versus UAW, and that's a class action case. And basically what happened is the court denied class certification on the grounds that maybe – I'm sorry, I back up a little bit. In Schloud, the state of Michigan forced about 50,000 home child care providers to pay fees to a union without giving them a choice. The union just basically took their money right out of state payments to them for providing child care to low-income children. After Harris – it was a case actually filed before Harris – but after Harris ruled, yes, that was unconstitutional, the court still refused class certification on the grounds that, well, maybe some of those child care providers didn't mind the union taking their money because they didn't object to it. And so the court denied class certification on those grounds, which resulted in the union being able to keep millions. And this is also an issue in a couple other class certification cases dealing with post-Harris, dealing with these independent providers of the same logic being used, that you can't have a class action against a union for taking fees without people's permission because you need proof of individual objection. So how the court rules on the opt-in, opt-out requirement could very much solve the class action question in Schloud and in some of these other provider cases.
It looks like we lost the one question we had on the board, so our lines are wide open now. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one question now, so let's take another call.
Hi. I was there at the argument today, and I was curious about the discussion at the beginning of the argument about the application that Friedrichs might have to the National Labor Relations Act and the Railway Labor Act, and I wonder what your take is on why that came up and what the justices were thinking about that, given that this Friedrichs is just a public sector case affecting public employees. Thank you.
Yes, that's a good question. And if memory serves me correctly, and again, you know, this is all from memory, one of Justice Kennedy's, I believe Justice Kennedy's first question was to petitioner's counsel, why doesn't this apply to the private sector? And petitioner's counsel's main answer was, well, in the public sector, the government does it directly. It literally, like in the state of California, the government literally just takes the money right from a public school teacher, you know, whether they like it or not. Well, in the private sector, the government authorizes compulsory unionism, but doesn't directly require it. And he argued that was a distinction with a difference. However, that quickly sort of turned into a discussion about state action under the Railway Labor Act. The court in the past has held there was state action under the Railway Labor Act, so that sort of moved into a discussion onto that point. And then the other, I believe, distinction Petitioner's Counsel made was in the private sector. You can't say the collective bargaining is political. You know, it's not directed at the government. And that's one of the main things that distinguishes public sector bargaining from private sector bargaining. One is directed at the government and is therefore political, and compelling support for that is no different than compelling support for a lobbying group, while one couldn't say the same of, you know, collective bargaining with General Motors. So I believe those are, at least the first point was definitely made by petitioners, and I believe the second was alluded to before the questioning pulled him in a different direction. And it was also, at very least, what the court said in Harris as far as there being a distinction there. But now on the other side, you know, as far as there is being state action in the private sector, Hansen remains good law. That's the case that held there is private state action under the Railway Labor Act, and there's very good reasons to believe that there is state action. Because while the government may not require compulsory fees, it does require exclusive representation. It does force employers to bargain with unions over compulsory unionism, whether they like it or not. And it also empowers the union to act as the exclusive representative of employees for purposes of bargaining that. So, you know, even without Hansen, a very strong argument can be made that the government is, in fact, you know, responsible for these compulsory fee agreements in the private sector. And that, therefore, what the Supreme Court holds in Friedrichs can be applied to the private sector. And a lot of times, or not a lot of times, I say that overall, the assuming that Friedrichs does overrule Abood, how it applies to the private sector depends a lot upon exactly what the Supreme Court says and its grounds for so holding on that point. So, for example, if the Friedrichs Court repudiates the free rider rationale, it's not making any sense or being a rational justification for compulsory fees, logically, that should extend to the private sector. There's really no difference in the rationales between public and private. But ultimately, it really depends on exactly what the court says, not just its ultimate conclusion, Friedrichs, to see how it applies to the private sector.
We've got a couple more questions pending, so let's carry on. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. Let's take another call.
Good afternoon, Don Perdue. I practice in D.C. Over the weekend, I was reading a commentary on the case that was making an argument that Abood should be upheld on the basis of stare decisis. And the commentary, did the parade of horribles that would happen if the case was overturned. And one of them puzzled me. The commentator, and I don't remember who it was, made the argument that before Abood, public union strikes were a big problem. After Abood, public union strikes dropped by 90%, and that somehow this was attributable to compulsory dues collection. Do you have any insight, and did this argument play any role in today's oral argument?
Yes, actually that argument did come up today. I believe it was the Union's counsel who made a very similar point. I believe he used New York as an example. He said that the same thing occurred there. Justice Scalia, I believe, expressed a great deal of skepticism on that point. And, you know, I can't remember exactly what Justice Scalia said, but I think it was to the point of how does that make sense? You know, how could it be that, you know, there were strikes and unrest, and then all of a sudden by forcing every employee to pay compulsory fees whether they like it or not, suddenly it made everyone content and happy. You know, of all things compulsory fees would do, making people happy is probably not one of them, or pacifying them. If anything, forcing them to support a union against their will, you know, would logically make them unhappy. And so, and I think just sort of looking at the bigger picture, what the union's trying to do is bring compulsory fees closer to the exclusive representation interest. Because really, Abood upheld compulsory fees on sort of a two-step. It said that exclusive representation, the government has an interest in dealing with one union exclusive representative for the interest of labor peace. And then it said compulsory fees for that exclusive representative are justified by the free rider rationale, because without compulsory fees, the union may not be able to engage in this exclusive representation and collective bargaining that the government has a compelling or has an interest in. And most of the argument what do you call it, from the petitioner's side, is that it's the second part here that doesn't make sense, that there is no connection between compulsory fees and exclusive representation. I'm sorry, not no connection, that they're not needed, and they're certainly not the least restrictive means, that even if the government does have an interest in dealing with one union to avoid strikes and such, that doesn't mean you need compulsory fees to support that union, because unions can obviously survive without compulsory fees. They do so in the federal government and 25 right-to-work states. And so what I believe the union's council is trying to do is try to show no, compulsory fees in and of themselves serve the interest of labor peace, not just exclusive representation to bring that interest closer. But as I said, personally, I don't see how that makes a whole lot of sense. How does forcing employees to pay dues to a union reduce, you know, make them not want to strike? And the court in the past, even in Abood, never adopted, you know, that kind of rationale. And I believe the court expressed a great deal of skepticism today, you know, on the idea that compulsory fees in and of themselves somehow serve the interest of labor peace.
We've got just one question pending. Let's take another call.
If regarding the opt-in, opt-out, I assume that were they to decide in favor of requiring an opt-in, and but for an opt-in, you don't pay dues, I would assume, even though this is a public sector case, that that then could be argued to be extended to the private sector?
Yes. Definitely the argument could be made. It depends somewhat. The previous caller's question about the private sector in general, it sort of depends on exactly how the court makes that ruling. You know, what's its basis? Because there's different ways one can approach the opt-in, opt-out question. And depending on the rationale the court adopts, that will greatly inform, you know, how easy it would be or difficult it would be to move that precedent to the private sector. However, I would say even in the private sector right now, here in California, at issue here is this annual objection requirement that every single year an employee has to object. So even if you say, don't take my money for politics, next year the union will do it again unless you tell them again. In the private sector, those have been, at least on the Railway Labor Act, struck down. There's actually a circuit split. Some courts have said they're okay, some haven't. But even in the private sector, the issue of annual objections, you know, has already been litigated on in the past. So it's definitely an issue there of whether objections can be required.
Thank you.
We do have another question pending, and we still have some time left, so if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
If I could venture another question related to the Pickering discussion, this fascinates and puzzles me because I normally think of Pickering as juxtaposing the employee's speech rights against the government's interest, and it seems like in this case, the government has to remain neutral as the employer when it comes to organizing and things like that. So what is this really a matter of the employee's interest versus the government's, or what am I missing here?
That's a good question. I mean, trying to make sense of Pickering and trying to apply this here, you know, sort of round peg, square hole, you know, at least the way I view the law. And I think that, you know, the main reason the respondents and the unions, and both in Harris in this case, are relying on it is that under exacting scrutiny, they have a very, very difficult road. Because exacting scrutiny requires not only a compelling interest, but also that it be the least restrictive means. And it's almost impossible for the unions to prove that compulsory fees are the least restrictive means for exclusive representation, given the existence of right-to-work states and exclusive representation in the federal government. So they've sort of hooked on to this idea of Pickering, which is interesting. And this did come up the argument today, is that Abood wasn't based on Pickering. I believe it was Justice Roberts asked, like, I forget exactly how he framed it, but the basis of the question was, you're defending on Abood on a rationale that not even Abood adopted. I believe the union's counsel begged to differ and said, well, it's the same general idea, but Abood never even cited Pickering. So they're sort of trying to come up with a new framework that would justify, just because it's a lower standard scrutiny. And the respondent's argument basically boils down to, well, if restricting employee speech is subject to Pickering, then so should compelling employee speech also be subject to the same test. However, there's a number of counterarguments to that. One is that, you know, when you have a categorical rule that's applicable to a large number of employees, the Pickering test isn't used. That's the NTEU case that I believe Petitioner's Counsel cited today at the argument. There's also the other one that escapes me right now, of that one of, I believe it's Justice Alito, alluded to an argument today about why he at least questioned whether Pickering applied here. And again, the court also distinguished it in Harris, which also dealt with compulsory fees. So really it comes down to a standard of scrutiny, what test to use. And really on that question, the law is somewhat settled. I mean, both Knox and Harris said exacting scrutiny. So one interesting sort of part of the union respondent's argument here is that to adopt their Pickering argument, you would almost have to overrule Abood and Knox. So this isn't just solely a question of do we overrule Abood. It's a question of do you overrule Abood or do you overrule Knox and Harris and other cases that say, no, this is the standard that applies. Because even before Knox and Harris, there's a whole line of precedent that says it's not the Pickering test here, it's this exacting scrutiny. Elrod, a case called O'Hare, there's others. And so that's one of the big issues here for stare decisis is which test do you use? It'll be very interesting to see how the court comes out on that. But I would assume that since they use the proper test in Harris and Knox, that will hopefully, you know, what they stick with.
Following up on that, as far as scrutiny goes, was there any mention today that Reed versus Gilbert and what it said about content-based restrictions being subjected to strict scrutiny has changed any of the equation or the thinking on how the court might go here?
No, to my recollection, neither came up. The Reed case, at least directly, didn't come to my knowledge. And also, I don't remember any real discussion about content-based versus non-content-based. A lot of the discussion as far as speech was really, you know, is this so-called political speech or matters of public concern, or is this internal employee speech, so to speak, which is sort of a distinction Pickering makes. Because the Pickering test, the first part of the Pickering test is, does this speech relate to a matter of public concern by the employee? If it doesn't, there's no constitutional test at all. You just lose. So if it's internal employee speech, the government can pretty much do it at once. Only if it relates to a matter of public concern do you move on to the next test where the government has to justify whatever it did to the employee based upon that speech. So that was the public concern issue was discussed a lot today, but the content-based never really came up, at least best that I can remember.
Let me make a call for a final question here. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. I don't see that final question. Let me, we do have a final question. Hold on.
Well, this is Jerry Hunter in St. Louis. I don't know if you've already addressed this, but it's my understanding that during the argument, Justice Breyer suggested that Abood should be upheld simply because it's been around for at least four decades and that the court's role is to maintain or to provide for stability. How was that issue addressed today or the responses to Justice Breyer's comment?
Oh, yes, it definitely did come up, both from Justice Breyer and I believe some of the other justices also raised stare decisis questions amongst the Harris dissenters. And there were basically three responses that I can remember. The first was that this is a core First Amendment right, and that was something said in Citizens United, that, you know, when it comes to core First Amendment rights, the court won't stick with it just because it's wrong. And that provoked a debate between the Petitioner's Counsel, and I believe it was Justice Breyer on that point where he thought of hypotheticals in which, you know, other First Amendment cases, or not First Amendment, other constitutional cases he thought were wrong but didn't necessarily mean that stare decisis didn't apply. So that brought up an issue. The second one mentioned is the scrutiny issue, which was pushed a lot in the briefs. It came up briefly today at argument, was, you know, this is a question of
you know, Abu did not apply this test. Now you have cases say this test applies mainly Knox and Harris. How do you make these precedents work? And actually, I believe there was one question from a justice, I'm sorry, I forget who it was, who sort of said, yes, you're right, you can draw lines that say that a lot of this jurisprudence doesn't all add together. And I believe the justice made the point that she thought that Abood fit well, but the petitioner's counsel's point was, no, it didn't. You know, Abood is an anomaly and an outlier in this otherwise consistent stream of law dealing with compelled expressive association. A third stare decisis argument that came up, I believe it came from the Chief Justice in a question to one of the respondents' counsel, was, you know, no one is defending Abood on its own rationale, that they're using a different rationale, this Pickering rationale, to justify Abood. So doesn't that undercut stare decisis? Because, you know, you're not even justifying the basis for the decision anymore. You're trying to come up with new reasons for it, which suggests it has problems. And then two other things on stare decisis. Reliance interest came up. I believe that was mainly from Justice Kagan. And there was a relatively spirited debate over if we did strike down, if they did, sorry, the Supreme Court struck down Abood, you know, what kind of effect would this have on union contracts? And petitioner's counsel argued was nothing. All it would mean is employees couldn't be forced to pay for it. You would just excise out one part. But some of the dissenting justices in Harris pushed back on that and said, no, it could have changed the entire structure of bargaining, because somehow, I believe the point was, maybe the union wouldn't have bargained for something, because basically the union usually would give up something for compulsory unionism, and that but for having to give up something to get compulsory fees, maybe the union would have pushed for something else. So the reliance interest issue definitely came up a lot today. I think in different parts of the argument, it sort of came back and went away, came back and went away. But stare decisis is something definitely the court is thinking about to a very large degree here, and there were a number of questions throughout the argument on that point. So as I sort of said at the beginning, I encourage everyone to read the transcript to see exactly what they said, because this is just, you know, my recollection.
Well, Bill, as you, based on your present employment, you would obviously be an expert on this issue, the reliance issue. Obviously, Indiana passed a right-to-work law, which the Supreme Court in Indiana appealed, and obviously that reliance issue, obviously the unions could have made that same argument in the state of Indiana, but they obviously have to adjust to the fact that the state passed a right-to-work law. So I don't know if the fact that states can pass right-to-work laws came up as a way of undercutting the reliance argument.
Yeah, I don't know if it came up in the reliance argument. It definitely came up in the question of whether the fees were the least restrictive means for collective bargaining. That came up a lot. But I don't know if it came up in the context of stare decisis. And, you know, as you said, you know, I think that the idea that there's a huge reliance interest is pretty weak just because they're in some contracts. I mean, if nothing else, actually not having compulsory unionism, you know, probably benefit employees. Because right now, unions will make concessions, you know, to get their pound of flesh. Without, you know, being able to go for compulsory fees, maybe they'll, you know, spend that bargaining capital, you know, on something that benefits employees and not just the union.
Well, Mr. Messenger, we've exhausted the questions and we've exhausted the allotted time here. I want to thank you so much for being with us a second time in as many weeks, recapping the argument. I hope that you'll join us again when we get a decision. I wish you luck with that. For our audience, thank you as well for dialing in such large numbers, and thank you for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about standing to sue, particularly as it relates to so many of the important cases brought by the states against the federal government. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.